Today on Seculo, Judge in Jack Smith case schedules document dump of evidence before the election.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. We want to hear from you. Share and post your comments or call 1-800-684-3110. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
Hey, welcome to Seculo, folks. Again, I'm on the road as I was yesterday, and we are here in West Virginia, actually. Some exciting news. One of our ACLJ alumni who has been with us and I've known since even before we went to law school and before we went to just while we were in undergrad. I think we were 18 years old when we met each other, J.B. McCuskey, who is a West Virginia native and has worked his way up through law school and then working with the ACLJ and was the state delegate to the House of Delegates here in West Virginia, moved up to the state auditor position and actually got the most votes in the state. He was the only Republican candidate who got more votes than President Trump in the last election cycle. So he's got a lot of support around the state of West Virginia. He's now the nominee for attorney general. So as you could imagine, we are really excited. We have ACLJ alumni set to take on positions like that and the influence that we'll both he'll be able to take with him to the attorney general's office. And we're also going to be opening up an office here in West Virginia to assist him and the state because they've got such a great team coming together to start the year. And that's really, you know, Will, regardless of the election, because it goes right to the heart of what we saw under the Trump administration. President Trump could get reelected and we've still got to take it to the federal government because the bureaucracy tries to stand in the way. Same thing goes if somehow Vice President Harris pulls something off, well, we're going to have a lot of work to do, both at the ACLJ nationally, but also work that we can do that emanates from states. So it's exciting news here in West Virginia as well. And there's a lot to talk about, of course, with this when it comes to legal news, Will, and this release that is going to be coming out later today, which is pure election interference lawfare at its worst.
That's right, Jordan. If you'll remember, we talked about on the broadcast just a little over a week ago that the judge released the brief that Jack Smith had filed with some redactions, but unsealed this evidentiary brief that Jack Smith had filed, trying to get ahead of the November 5th election. But now Judge Chutkan has ordered that today the appendices, the documents, the records, all of the primary documents, if you will, of the evidence that went into that brief shall be made public today. She is unsealing this and actually with a very interesting twist, trying to say she's not interfering in the election by putting this out. But I want to read this quote here and then we'll talk about it more in the next segment. There is undoubtedly a public interest in courts not inserting themselves into elections or appearing to do so. But litigation's incidental effects on politics are not the same as a court's intentional interference with them. As a result, it is in fact defendants' requested relief that risk undermining the public interest. If the court withheld information that the public otherwise had a right to access solely because of the potential political consequences of releasing it, that withholding could itself constitute or appear to be election interference. So, Jordan, Judge Chutkan here is trying to flip it on President Trump, saying that no, you're the one that wants to interfere with the election if I were to not make this public. I don't think it passes the smell test, though.
No, not at all. And we'll explain that circular reasoning when we get back on Seculo. But as you can see, we are doubling down our efforts on election integrity. We're doubling down our efforts to prepare for what comes after Election Day as well. We need your support. Defend election integrity. Go to ACLJ.org. Donate today if you can, because we need lawyers and attorneys ready to go across the country. We want to be able to assist you now. If you had problems with the early voting or issues being a poll watcher, contact us at ACLJ.org/help. We've got these resources available and attorneys available for you. And we know that this fight is not going to necessarily be over on Election Day. Support the work of the ACLJ. Donate today. We'll be right back. taking your calls too. 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. So as we said, Judge Chutkan in Washington, D.C. on the January 6th case is prepared to release additional evidence today on Donald Trump prepared by Jack Smith. Remember, he had to go and refile before a new grand jury after that Supreme Court case that gutted most of Jack Smith's initial case trying to involve President Trump and say he was part of a conspiracy to lead this overthrow of the U.S. government and the riots, and that he's responsible because he gave a speech and told people to behave and told people not to do and take these kind of actions. But he filed again, and we saw that filing released a couple weeks ago with the kind of new charges. And basically, we worked through it and said, you know, two of those four charges the Supreme Court has already thrown out. So really, Jack Smith, again, this is a political hit job. And now we have, on a Friday drop, more evidence that was attached to. This was in the appendix that Jack Smith filed that he's asked for the court to release with minimal redactions. The only reason to do this is to interfere with the elections. And Judge Chutkan trying to say that if she didn't release this, it would interfere with the elections is the exact opposite role of why we have these court systems and how these court systems must be regulated. When you have court systems like this, you cannot let them decide when they are going to drop evidence on someone who cannot yet have an opportunity to respond to that evidence in court. They have not had an opportunity to go to court and respond to the evidence and see if they are what, if they are being able to toss it out. Some of this evidence I don't even think will make it into trial. But you know what it's going to make it into today, Will? And that's the most troubling part, the media.
That's right, Jordan. And if you go back to someone who we don't normally quote too much for positive purposes, but actually he is pretty intellectually honest when it comes to legal analysis. It's Eli Honig from CNN. He's the one who wrote in New York Magazine that this is Jack Smith's October cheap shot. And he goes on to say that the conduct here by Jack Smith violates core DOJ principle and policy with the way he asked the judge to do the order of this, with the brief, with getting the evidence out. So even the fact that left of center legal commentators who are calling it as a straight shooter here, that Judge Chutkan should be able to see through this. And Harry, I want to get your thoughts on this. The judge is trying to say that if she didn't release this publicly available information, that would be election interference. But in reality, she has allowed Jack Smith to violate DOJ policy, go out of order, switch around the timeline so that he can get all this information out, the alleged evidence here, before the election so the public can see it before any concept of a trial has begun.
Absolutely. So essentially, Judge Chutkan has got her logic and her legal analysis exactly backward. So she decides to release these allegations in order, in my opinion, to interfere in the election. But then she claims that Trump's efforts to block this information before the election is an attempt to interfere. So she must release it according to her strained logic. Keep in mind that the judge in the election interference case, Judge Chutkan, is releasing additional unredacted appendices days before the election. But we should note that no proven evidence is being released. Only allegations are being released. We are only seeing one side of the equation. And the purpose of this release is to damage Trump's campaign, which is precisely why Trump and his legal team opposed it. Second, what we are seeing is simply more DOJ election interference and legal abuse as Jack Smith engages in a sustained effort to Bob McDonnell himself. And what do I mean by McDonnelling himself? Essentially, Jack Smith is giving us a political show trial that recalls Arthur Kessler's great book, Darkness at Noon, which basically went through the situation of show trials under the Stalinist regime. So what we have is election interference, and then basically Judge Chutkan and Jack Smith are claiming, no, Trump is trying to interfere by blocking the introduction of these allegations. So it is a crazy, crazy legal situation. And I would suggest it is really time for Jack Smith and Judge Chutkan to go back to law school.
And Jordan, to Harry's point as well, the judge here is trying to argue that this is should be publicly available information, that the public is entitled to evidence in a trial. And while that may be true, what is so glaring here is the way that things are being done out of order. Typically, yes, that evidence is presented at trial, and that evidence would be public in a trial setting, except for maybe in some very rare circumstances. But this isn't at the trial phase yet. There's no jury that has been called. This is preliminary evidentiary hearings that have resulted in publicly released information. You typically think about things like discovery and evidence where the defense and the prosecution are privy to what's going on, but it seems completely out of order that they're saying, let's just post it all online before the election. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that this is, again, it's ultimate lawfare at its worst. These judges who have any potential to do any damage to President Trump, even though they had to toss out the initial case that Jack Smith brought against President Trump because the Supreme Court clearly said, most of what you're trying to charge here, you can't do because the president is protected when he acts officially. And you're going to have to go through every one of these little pieces of evidence and argue in court how, if you're a prosecutor, that wasn't an official act while he was president of the United States and how that was somehow unofficial and how are you going to draw that line. So the fact is, like Harry said, a lot of this evidence could ultimately be tossed out of court because they have to play this very interesting and unique style of prosecution if they do move forward with this, which, let me tell you, if President Trump wins the election, this case will go nowhere further. So what they're looking to do now is say, well, we may never get a trial on this, so let's do every piece of damage we could possibly do to President Trump before and as people are casting their votes today. I mean, we're 18 days out from Election Day, but we're getting in, you know, probably by Election Day, nearly half the country will have already voted, and they will have this kind of information without a full, again, we know it's coming out today, without a full response from the Trump team. So as we are seeing, and as we've seen in the past, they will, again, they use circular reasoning to somehow say, yeah, we're supposed to keep things, you know, when we have it, we're this close to an election. I mean, we're 18 days out, for goodness sakes. We're not supposed to get involved. The judiciary is not supposed to make decisions that could sway people one way or the other because they already had to decide that they couldn't move forward with the trial. They've already had to refile charges because of the Supreme Court case. So this case, it wasn't going to be heard for a very long time. So many motions coming. But yet, will they figure out a way to try and get anything possible in that appendix? And the only reason I think Jack Smith could possibly want this out is that this is his final shot. He knows that he is not going to be able to move forward with this case anytime soon, and especially if President Trump wins. So this is his final opportunity to try and damage the president of the former president of the United States just 18 days out. And we have got to stand up and realize that he must think, Will, that usually these appendixes wouldn't be so much different than what he was already released with some redactions. There must be something in there that he thinks is important enough to try and, as he did, convince a judge that she's not interfering with the election by releasing it. There's something fishy here that we are going to have to be on the lookout for.
That's right, Jordan. And to some degree, he also may know that the media will do his bidding by writing stories, by laying it out, coming up with their own conclusions based off the evidence, and do a lot of his job for him. And I want to read this quote one more time from Judge Chutkan. If the court withheld information that the public otherwise had a right to access solely because of the potential political consequences of releasing it, withholding it could itself constitute or appear to be election interference. It sounds like she's telling the American people, you're the jury now. You get to decide if he's guilty or not in this case. And that's actually not how the American legal system works, where you are innocent until proven guilty by a jury of your peers. Folks, thank you for supporting and watching the ACLJ. We're at a very critical moment with just 18 days left. We are fighting for election integrity. Go to aclj.org/vote to sign our petition to defend the Constitution and donate at aclj.org.
All right, welcome back to Seculo. As you can tell, I'm on the road. Will Smith, our producer, senior producer, he's in the studio. So again, we are going to be taking your phone calls, 1-800-684-3110. Second half hour, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's on our team, is going to break down the importance of the IDF and Israel taking out Yahya Sinwar, who was initially the head of the Hamas military unit, so the terror unit that would fire missiles, kill Israelis, kill Americans, that, of course, coordinated with Iran and Hezbollah. But then when Ismail Haniyeh from Hamas was taken out by the IDF and by Israel, when he visited Tehran, Hamas elevated Yahya Sinwar to be the head of the entire Hamas terrorist organization. And he was taken out by the IDF, and we want to get Secretary Pompeo's thoughts because we're already starting to see a pushback from the Biden and Harris team, Harris especially now saying, you know what, it's time for, you know, this to come to a quick conclusion. But there are still nearly 100 hostages unaccounted for. We believe at least 67 or so of those may still be alive. Unfortunately, another 33, we believe, are no longer with us. That includes potentially up to 4 Americans who are being still held hostage somewhere in the Gaza Strip. And so this cannot be over until those hostages and the bodies of those who were brutally killed by this terrorist organization are ultimately released. And the Biden administration, as well as the world, needs to push hard on that point instead of telling Israel, well, you've taken out the head of the snake, so you should be able to walk away now. You can't walk away. They still have your citizens being held hostage. What they are doing, though, is proving to the world that Israel is back and that when you take on Israel, even with a surprise attack, there may have been failures on Israel's security part on October 7th. They can quickly rebound, and you've seen the amount of terror leaders who have been hidden for decades lose their life because of their involvement with October 7th and the blood on their hands, not just of Israelis, but of Americans, of Muslims, of people inside their own countries and territories as well. And so we'll get into all the details about that. That was just breaking yesterday while we were on the broadcast. And a little bit of levity too, Will.
That's right.
Last night, the Al Smith dinner in New York, there was a couple things. One, Donald Trump had no problem going with all the issues he's facing, knowing that the crowd is not a crowd that is necessarily, you know, 80% for Trump. But Harris, nowhere to be found. She sent in some pre-recorded junk video that even the left is mocking as just cringy and bizarre. And I don't think it deserves to be played, because if you don't show up, you're too afraid to show up to give jokes out that are, again, to try to show that we're a country that we can still joke around about. Even 18 days out before an election between political opponents, she couldn't do it. She's either not, her team doesn't think she can deliver jokes or deliver the lines, or that she doesn't have any sense of humor. But President Trump, as usual, hilarious.
That's right. And we'll play a clip here because I think it's funny. I want to show kind of the levity of it. It seemed that President Trump was having fun. The people in the audience were dying laughing at this. But there's also clips we can't play. Like, I would say it was a bit of a gamble for the Trump writers. I know that they worked with some people at Fox, actually. I could see maybe Greg Gutfeld's fingerprints on some of these jokes. But he rolled the dice a little bit. And I think that's also what makes him so endearing to many people, is that he is willing to take risks like this. But let's go ahead and play bite number four of President Trump during his portion at the Al Smith dinner last night.
Tradition holds that I'm supposed to tell a few self-deprecating jokes this evening. So here it goes. Nope. I've got nothing. I've got nothing. There's nothing to say. I guess I just don't see the point of taking shots at myself when other people have been shooting at me.
I mean, you know, it's a sad reality, but the fact that he can, still humorize it and make it, again, take it down to that level, I think was hilarious. That, you know, usually you would make more self-deprecating jokes, but it was, in a sense, the ultimate self-deprecating joke to say, yeah, I'm not going to take shots on myself. I got enough people taking shots on me right now, including a bullet that he did take. It does underscore a very serious point, which I believe we're in that zone. And I think, Will, really, we're going to be in a very, what could be, dangerous time, and a time we need to really be on guard. And that's these 18 days. And then if President Trump is victorious, ultimately, the days between Election Day and when he actually takes the oath of office. I just don't trust the left, the rhetoric, or what kind of moves they may try to make to keep President Trump out of the Oval Office and out of the presidency. But he had some other good lines too.
That's right, Jordan. But I also, you mentioned that 18 days to go, but then also that period after the election. And I want you to tell people a little bit about what you did last night in West Virginia, some of the conversations you had with these leaders in West Virginia, and also a state that is expected to be one of the reddest of red this election cycle, but still the importance of voting, even in a red state where you think my vote may not count, why it's so important to still be engaged in the political process and use your constitutional right to vote at a time like this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a message I have for everybody who lives in a dark red state and everybody who lives in a deep blue state, but is going to vote, you know, likely for President Trump, is a conservative person and other Republicans. You've got to get out there. Your vote matters, one, because if everybody felt that way, you can live in the reddest state in the country and guess what? Still lose. Because even if you say, oh, well, he's going to win by 20 or 30 points here in our state, so I don't have to worry about it so much. Yes, you do, because if everybody takes that mindset, that 20 and 30 votes can get a lot closer. So that's part one. Part two, if you live in a blue state as well, your vote still gets counted to the popular vote. Now, the popular vote is not how you get elected in the United States of America. But we know that, and I addressed the West Virginia at their Lincoln Day dinner 19 days out before the election, as their special speaker to come in and deliver the message about, of course, the legal, the lawfare. The room was packed. I mean, there were probably 450 people packed into a room. It was cold outside, so it was hot inside. And, you know, most of all of the leaders running for statewide office or holding statewide office are there. And there were two big points to be made. And every one of them, and Will, I was the main speaker, so I got to see the shorter speeches as well leading up to my remarks. Every one of us knew that we had to get that message across, that we have got to get as many votes possible because it doesn't matter if you're voting in a red state, that still counts towards the popular vote. Not because any of us want to move to a popular vote system, but we know that part of the left strategy after this election, win or lose, is going to try and be, one, if it's Donald Trump as president, they want to try and undermine him as president. It's saying he didn't get the popular vote. So there's also states looking at saying, we're going to change our law and we're going to only give our delegates next election, general election, to the state, to whoever wins the popular vote. They will get all of our electoral college votes. And we know there's billionaires on the left looking at funding campaigns to try and fool you into thinking it's better to go to a popular vote. So that's why we're here in West Virginia, to make sure we get out the vote big. We know we can win. We got to get it out big. And we're also here to protect the vote. At ACLJ.org, we need your help. Donate today. Our teams are already fighting to protect your vote.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
All right, welcome back to Seculo. We are got a lot to talk about politically, of course, as well as the implications of the IDF and Israel taking out the head of Hamas, who was always head of the military wing, the most dangerous wing, terror wing of Hamas, that also put was the lead planner for the October 7th attack on Israel. Yahya Sinwar is someone, again, who was an evil person whose entire goal was to eliminate the Jews from the state of Israel and then ultimately eliminate the state of Israel completely. And that, again, that there could be no peace if Israel even existed. And ultimately, what he was doing was surrounding himself with human shields by using the hostages. Something changed, and I think that's because we've seen these other leaders fall, both from Hamas and Hezbollah. And so he looked like he was going to try and escape. He was found with a fake passport. It said on his passport, by the way, that he was a UN teacher from UNRWA, that organization we've talked about where they want to give everyone that works there, who even worked with Hamas, a global immunity from prosecution, even if they were involved in the October 7th attacks. He had $10,000 in cash. He had weapons. He had a vest with grenades. I mean, he was trying to, and a couple of bodyguards. No evidence that there were any of the hostages around him, and he was above ground. So we're going to get into that with Secretary Pompeo, because the ramifications are huge, and that the push from each party here is very different if you listen to Harris or if you listen to Trump. And will we also have a major case, Shahryar Gill, who's based here in the U.S., but is from Pakistan and overseas, just to remind you, our office in Pakistan has been working tirelessly with our team there and here on a death row case, and we are going to trial. It's very hard to get judges to show up in these blasphemy cases because the judges then come under threat. But, Will, it's happening, and we've also got to pray for those judges that they do show up, because sometimes even at the last minute, they try to make up excuses not to be there. Justice doesn't get done, and Shahzad could end up being executed.
That's right. And if you've been a listener or viewer of this broadcast for any amount of time, you've probably heard us talk about the case of Shahzad Masih. This was a young man who, as a minor in 2017, was sentenced to death by hanging in Pakistan for the alleged crime of blasphemy against the Prophet Muhammad. The allegation was that he told someone he worked with, whenever a friend of his father's hears the name Muhammad, he curses. And that was enough. This hearsay anecdote was enough that local court system, which is not great, but many times you can get justice in Pakistan in the higher courts, convicted him after pressure from the town of blasphemy, which the sentence was death by hanging. We've been fighting for this for years. He's been in prison for 7 years on death row. I can report that Shahryar Gill has spoken with him by phone while he is in Pakistan, and they are preparing. We just showed images for this oral argument on October 28th at the Lahore High Court in Pakistan to try and secure the release of Shahzad Masih, something we have fought a long time for, and we are praying. We encourage you to pray as well for this, that justice will be served and that he will be released and be able to get away from even the violent mobs that may try to retaliate.
Folks, again, just a reminder of the work that the ACLJ does around the world, protecting the religious liberty of the most vulnerable. And we've got those teams who are willing to be there, both based in the U.S. and Pakistan, who know what it means to stand up for religious liberty inside Pakistan for the least of these. And they're willing to fight that fight. And we are so proud to partner with them as one of our organizations at the American Center for Law and Justice to make that international stand for religious liberty and fight back against the extremism that leads to terrorism all over the world. Support the work of the ACLJ. You know, we are focused, though. We are laser focused on the election. We got 18 days, and we know it's not just going to be Election Day. Welcome back to Seculo. We are taking your phone calls to 1-800-684-3110. We're going to get to them in the next segment of the broadcast. So stay with us if you are on the lines. We will take all of those calls in the next segment of the broadcast. But right now we're joined by our senior counsel for global affairs, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And Secretary Pompeo, first, before getting into Sinwar, I wanted to ask you this. You were also an attending. You attended last night's Al Smith dinner in New York. I wanted to get your takeaway. One, I mean, I think President Trump was hilarious, but that bigger takeaway that Kamala Harris was nowhere to be found.
Jordan, it was really a special evening, an important evening. Raised a bunch of money for young people that need help. The Catholic Church does an amazing job of hosting the dinner. You know, it's a deep tradition that both candidates show up, and it's unexplainable to me that Vice President Harris would just so disrespect Cardinal Dolan, the church, and the event, and this tradition in history. I don't know why she chose not to be there. President Trump did a very nice job. He was very direct about the things that matter, and he's pretty darn funny. As Jordan, you've been around him some. We both know that he can be. And I was really happy to be able to be there to see President Trump and Melania, and then also to be able to help a really important charitable organization.
Yeah, I mean, she tried to send in some kind of video, and even the left said, you know, it was cringy. That doesn't work in that setting. And it actually, even though it is, you know, it's comedy, it kind of is an opportunity to show a more human side of people who kind of are only usually seen as from their political side or leadership side or on stages at rallies and maybe don't get as much of the humor. And instead, she tried to do it by video. Even the left said that did not necessarily satisfy anyone. It was pretty cringy, to say the least. I mean, ultimately, I don't think it's going to decide the outcome of the election, but it does show that her team is obviously just afraid to put her out there in any kind of situation like that, doesn't know how she'd react, even though everybody's got using great, you know, comedic writers to help them prepare for those great lines. But I want to get to some serious stuff, too. And it is serious what that dinner does, which is raise that money for those kids in need. But I want to really get your take on the IDF taking out Yahya Sinwar, because this in Rafah, above ground, in the city where Biden, Harris, and the left around the world have told Israel, you know, don't go to Rafah, hundreds of thousands will die, and on a routine IDF, they were moving around the city. And they were able to locate him by drone above ground. Pretty amazing.
Jordan, this is a big deal. And it demonstrates that the Israeli version of how to keep their nation safe was the right one here. Your point's well taken. Not only would Sinwar be alive, the man who orchestrated the October 7th massacre, but so would Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah. So would Hania, the political leader of Hamas. And so would hundreds and hundreds of terrorists who've killed so many Israelis and threatened the Gulf Arab states and America. To demand a ceasefire was a mistake. It would be a mistake even today. In the end, Jordan, the Israelis are going to demand that the new leadership of Hamas surrender, that the new leadership of Hamas recognize Israel's right to exist. They don't demand that there could be another October 7th, and they put down their weapons. That's the task. Perhaps we've reached an inflection point. That the next man up in Hamas will actually accede to that. But I'll bet that the Iranians won't let that happen. I'll bet the Iranians will not let a reasonable leader rise to lead Gaza, the people of Gaza. They will demand that it still be a jihadist terror organization leader they put back in charge.
I thought it was interesting, Secretary Pompeo, about what was found with Sinwar, because it just kind of underscores some other interesting issues we've been working on at the ACLJ and through our European Center for Law and Justice and even at the UN, because he was found with a counterfeit, or maybe real, but definitely one that had been worked on, a UNRWA employee ID, so that he could try to use this false ID. I guess it appears that he was trying to make a run for it, $10,000 in cash, even had a pack of Mentos, which was part of an aid packages that were supposed to be going to the people, but of course went to Hamas leadership and did not usually make their way to the people who are suffering in Gaza because of the Hamas control of the Gaza Strip. But this idea, again, that under your administration, there was a defunding of UNRWA, and it was very important to do that because they were unwilling to clean house. We know that there were a number of people at UNRWA who were part of the October 7th attacks, and they had family members who were part of the October 7th attacks, and they had family members, or they were also officially part of Hamas. And, you know, we've seen the UN say that they are calling for a universal system where they cannot be prosecuted. They're a universal immunity around the world. But it was interesting to me that even Sinwar himself tied to UNRWA and thought that was a ticket to try and move around Gaza and get out potentially.
Jordan, we knew 7 years ago, that the UN World Refugee Agency there, UNRWA, was corrupt, that we knew that they had connections to terrorists, and we knew that UN money or American taxpayer money ought never to go to them. They weren't providing civilian relief. They were providing succor to the terrorists. And you could see it yesterday when Sinwar perished. He was either hiding behind a false ID or working so closely with them, they gave him one. And we have seen other folks helping hide terrorists that were ostensibly UNRWA employees. Why the Biden administration chose that that's the organization we're going to use to deliver humanitarian assistance to the needy people of Gaza is beyond me, because this was literally providing material support to terrorists in ways that are never in America's best interest. And we need to be mindful as people are thinking, well, goodness, now we've turned the corner. Maybe this is a chance for something different. The UN cannot possibly be put back in charge of security in Gaza, or for that matter, in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank. The UN has demonstrated that, or for that matter, UNIFIL, the failure they've had up in Lebanon to keep the Israelis safe and secure under UN Security Council Resolution 1701. The UN cannot be trusted. It is an organization with deep anti-Semitic roots, and we can't let them get back anywhere where they're responsible for either the health and welfare of the citizens they're assigned to, or to keep terrorists at bay and do their job and keep peace.
Kind of a two-part question. One is, how do you think this affects overall the death of Sinwar? You've got the next kind of leader in line is another one of the leaders who is actually in Doha, so he's not on the ground in Gaza. That would be Khalid Mashal, who I think would be technically next in line for Hamas. But how do you think it affects the efforts to get to an end of the conflict we're seeing in Gaza? And ultimately, the second part to that question, obviously, the remaining hostages were not surrounding Yahya Sinwar anymore. And we know that's up to 97 people. And hopefully, as of last reported, that there were at least 60 plus of those who we believe are still alive as of last report. And I think, you know, if Hamas wants to get to any kind of ceasefire, they've got to figure out how to return those hostages. And we saw Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel offer amnesty to those who return hostages who may have been put in their homes.
Look, I'm hopeful that this will lead to a resolution that gets these hostages returned to their families. This would be Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli leadership's intention. That's why they have pressed the case so diligently these past 14 months, 13 and a half months. I don't see a clear path to it. Having said that, this does give the Israelis political space to move, but you still have tens of thousands of Israelis that can't return to their home. You still have terrorists all throughout the north and even in and around Rafah that are still active in the region. There's still more work to be done, because in the end, Jordan, you and I both know this, that Tehran is the problem. This isn't a problem just in Gaza or just in Lebanon or just in Yemen. This is a problem driven out of Tehran. And to date, no cost has been imposed on the Iranians, other than they've had some of their proxies now nearly decimated. We shouldn't think for a second that the conclusion of this has occurred because Sinwar is gone. We need to try and get these hostages home as quickly as we can and encourage and support, not threaten the Israelis with withdrawing arms, as the Biden administration has done, but encourage them to finish the task that's in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, now it's actually a goal. Some of these sounded that they were going to be so difficult to ever locate. You know, could you ever locate Nasrallah and take him out? Could you ever locate someone like Sinwar and take him out without the loss of too many even Israeli lives or American lives and other hostages' lives? And yet we've seen now in these past few weeks, I think the Israeli intelligence, Israeli and the IDF operating at its best, you know, really over this last year, coming back together to be that Israeli defense forces and intelligence units that they are known for and feared by their enemies. And Secretary Pompeo, I appreciate you taking that time to break it down for people, because that's always the first question everyone has. Okay, what happens next, likely? What are the other options now available for Israel? And when you look at Israel too, folks, remember, when they try to call Israel the extremist on this, after Sinwar's death, Prime Minister Netanyahu had a clear message to the Palestinian people in Gaza. He said, if you have one of those hostages or a couple of those hostages that were put in your home by Hamas, if you turn them back over to Israel, you will have amnesty. We're not going to try to come after you. Sounds like the reasonable side. Doesn't sound like the side of terror. Hamas is the side of terror. Support our work. Donate today at ACLJ.org. We come back. Phone calls and politics. Welcome back to Seculo. You know what, folks? I do want to encourage you to take more time. If you didn't watch more of those jokes from the Al Smith dinner, if you've got friends and family who are kind of like on the line about President Trump and they think he's, you know, too serious or he's, you know, this threat to democracy, I think by showing the ability to use humor, it really pushes back on that whole idea and the fact that Kamala Harris wouldn't even try to show up. So it's all available online. Again, the jokes are funny. The jokes are, I think, biting, but they were also appropriate. And again, most politicians should be tough enough to take them. But Will, we got a lot of calls coming in.
That's right.
We're 18 days out from the election, and I want to get to them.
Let's go ahead and go to Carol in New York on line one. Carol, you're on Seculo.
Thank you very much. I'm calling. I'm a chaplain in New York. My husband passed away in 2010. And I still get mail, and for him to vote early and all those other things. I went to the office. I told him the same thing, but I still get the mail. My question is this. I could go with take a man out the street and have him go vote in place of my husband, because there's no picture or proof it's not my husband. I call it a game of not politics, but politrics. And how do I know this is not happening other places where they're registering the unalived?
Well, I think that there's two things. I mean, we know we are going to get involved in Virginia there, because it's a great example, Carol, where there were 6,000 lawful permanent residents in Virginia when they were filling out their paperwork this year, marked that they were non-citizens. And so the governor there and the legislature said, you know, we need to make sure they're not on the voter rolls for two reasons. One, we don't want them to get in trouble. Because if we start sending them, hey, make sure you go out and vote or voter registration cards, then they could end up going and then committing a crime that we pushed them to, you know, confused them to do. And second is that we want to protect the integrity of our elections. We know these individuals, they told us they are not citizens, so their names should be taken off of the voter rolls. Guess who sued Virginia with 19 days to go before the election just yesterday? The Department of Justice. So there is an interest in the Harris team and campaign of keeping even people who are alive but are not citizens potentially on the voter rolls. And Will, that speaks to only one thing, which is that when you get ballots flying around, whether or not it's people who are deceased, whether or not it's people who have moved, whether it's people who should legally not be voting in the election, even if they're lawful residents here, it does make people question the integrity of the election. And one idea I'm actually thinking about more and more as we hear these stories, I think the left is actually putting this out to try and undermine the right's faith in the election process so that we don't go and vote. So that you think, you know what, this election is going to get stolen. This election is not going to be, this election is not going to be handled legally. And there's no way to win if they break all the rules. And so I think there's a double-edged sword to this, Will. It's not just about actually getting the voter rolls cleaned up. It's also about getting stories out that they know undermine the conservatives' faith in our election process.
That's right, Jordan. And I also want to encourage people, if you go to aclj.org/voting rights, that's aclj.org/voting rights, we have a lot of materials there for you so you can know your rights, whether it be registering to vote, if you're, which at this point we're 18 days out, but whether it be at the polling place, things of that nature. It's a great tool, but also you can go to aclj.org/help if you feel like there is this very specific issue and you need to get in touch with an attorney. Well, let's go to Mike from Utah on line two. Mike, you're on Seculo.
Thanks. Love you guys. Listen to you in the podcast form every day at lunch. My question is really specific. There's many states that are now working to change voter laws in such a way that their constitution will be changed so that they disenfranchise their voters if the popular vote doesn't agree with the way the voters want. What is ACLJ doing to combat that before we end up in a constitutional crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is going to be the next battle, as we know. And Will and I have talked about that. Our legal team have talked about that. I talked about it last night as one of the things to watch out for here in West Virginia and red states as well, because I think there's a two-prong campaign, Will. The first prong is they won't be able to do that before this election, obviously. So they're going to start floating that as an idea for states that are, you know, probably more deeply blue states, to say, you know what, we're willing to give all of our Electoral College votes over to whoever wins the popular vote, which disenfranchises, as you said, all of the voters in our state. Now, most of, there's not a lot of red states or purple states that's going to go through. But there's going to be a second campaign if President Trump wins, but there is a decent disparity between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote, which shouldn't matter, because to run for president, it tells you what you need to do to win. And winning the popular vote doesn't get you to the Oval Office. It never has. But what they want to do then is run a billionaires-backed campaign to try and convince not just the left, but all Americans that you are going to be empowered by this move, because your vote will directly be counted for the president, for the presidential elections. And Will, we know that's going to be done in a way that tries to bring Republicans along well and confuse voters out there to think that that's somehow better and more democratic than our Electoral College process. I could get into this for hours right now.
Right.
And here's the truth. We're ready to combat it at the ACLJ, Will. We will be fighting that. And we know that is what's coming next. I think whoever wins this election, that's coming next. But I think if Donald Trump is victorious, the speed that this happens is going to be very rapid, and the ACLJ is great at working at rapid speed because of our support from our donors.
And Jordan, it's also important to point out that's why the down ballot races, like state legislators or your congressmen and women or your senators, are so vital, because if you just blow them off or think that that doesn't really affect my life, no, it could actually affect how we elect our president down the line if you're not paying attention to those races. So let's go to one final call for the day. Annabelle from California, ACLJ champion, you're on the air.
Hi, Will and Jordan. You know, you just said it, but regardless of who wins the presidency, it's going to be a Herculean task to unravel the web of damage to our freedom and to decency that the radical left has woven, strangling our nation. I just want to give a quick example on Prop 3 in California, where all limitations on marriage could be lifted between, get this, whomever or whatever, mocking the family grievously. Brilliant and innovative legal minds must be called upon to restore fundamental rights and sanity to our country. The ACLJ and its illustrious team epitomizes these qualities and is unsurpassed in its effectiveness to take on this daunting challenge. Please join me and the other ACLJ champions to become patriotic warriors. Our future is at stake. God bless the ACLJ. God bless America. And vote early.
God bless you, Annabelle. We appreciate our ACLJ champions so much. You know, these are individuals, folks, that decide a monthly amount that they will donate to the ACLJ, and they put in the card of their choice online at aclj.org/champions, and that amount is automatically deducted monthly. And that lets us know that we have a certain amount of donations coming in each month, so we know that we have the resources where we never have to turn down a case because it's going to cost too much. And I always want to be in that position at the ACLJ. Now, you can become a one-time donor and donate today at ACLJ.org, or you can become an ACLJ champion at ACLJ.org/champions. But we always want to be there for you, and that's by having the resources to fight battles large and small.